And now, it's back to Cooks and Shungu on 702.
18 minutes before 10 o'clock, time for us to speak books in our literature corner and the long-anticipated memoir from acclaimed, internationally acclaimed writer Margie Orford is out. It's a memoir called Love and Fury. And to tell us about the memoir, we're joined by Margie on the line. Margie, a very good morning to you. Welcome to Weekend Breakfast.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
It's good. It's
at Cape St. Francis, so it's a bit of a cheat. I've been on the beach already this morning.
Oh, such a show off. Such a show off. But we'll forgive it.
Thank you.
So, Margie, this time, I mean, you've written numerous books that have been translated into, you know, many languages. But this time you are writing, I guess you are the subject. You are the story. It is a memoir called Love and Fury. Why the decision to publish a memoir?
Many, many different reasons. One is that I was commissioned by my wonderful publisher, Jonathan Ball, to do it. By two fabulous editors, Nkanyezi Chabalala, who was there, and then Nicole Duncan. And they were so interested. They were sort of women who were kind of half a generation younger than me, I guess. And I just, they were sort of curious about my life and what I'd done. And I mean, most of us, who you were talking about working and work, you sort of just don't think about stuff. You just kind of do it and do it. And I think women do things faster and faster. And then I suppose in my sort of mid, late 40s, early 50s, I hit this real kind of crisis, you know, everything, family, work, everything just suddenly lost its momentum and its purpose. And I was at this very dark place in my life where I just couldn't kind of get a way to go on or move on. Anyone who's had depression, I didn't even really think of the word at the time, will recognize this. And it was this, I had to sort of account for myself and what I'd done. You know, I mean, anyone who knows my work knows I've looked at gender-based violence and violence against women. And I had thought for many years working, I could look and write about the most terrible things done to women and children and somehow as a journalist not and a writer not be affected by it and not find my own story in it. So it was, it kind of, one of the taglines on the book is that it saved me, this book. It really did. I think I had to kind of reassemble something that had shattered and tell a story of what it is to be a woman in the world, I suppose.
Yes. And so, you know, you write about how you've dealt or written about the issues of gender and violence, and I guess the story of other women, other mothers and wives, etc. And here in this book, you then use your writing about yourself. And I wonder if that was as difficult, if not more difficult, because, well, you are, it is your story, you are the subject. There isn't an opportunity to, I guess, be removed from it. And I guess it's quite a vulnerable process as well.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's, they're kind of different requirements for the truth. Like if you write a novel, a fiction, the world that you create must feel truthful and believable for your reader to be transported by it. And in a memoir, in a way I thought of it, it's like making the story of yourself, the house of oneself. It's a way of inviting other people into it. I was born with the gift of language, or, you know, that was my skill, I suppose, or my ability. So I thought of it very much as a way of opening myself, not as a way of being like vain or showing off. I grew up in South Africa as well, and you know, kids are not meant to show off. It's a way of trying to get what it feels like, what it felt like to live in this place, to live in the world, and then invite people in. And it's amazing. I've had the most incredible response of people writing to me saying, what you said echoes so much with my own experience. And I can feel the like relief and pleasure in someone finding where it makes sense. That's been my experience of other people's books. You find yourself in somebody else. So you kind of offering a form of community through communication. And then my best one, this woman wrote to me and she said, because a lot of men have been reading this book. I mean, it's you know, it's a book about women, and most men are a bit afraid of fury because with good reason, they usually deserve it. And she said to me, my husband has been reading my book and it's just opened up so much conversation between us about what it's been like for me to live in this place and how her husband had been in relation. I thought, wow, that means a lot to be, to open the space between men and women to talk about each other and how to be together. I don't know. I found that a great honor. I just thought, okay, that was worth it. The whole book was worth it if these two people are talking to each other because of what I wrote about being a woman in the world.
And so the book also, I guess, gives insight into how you come to be focused on the work that you're focused on, the themes that you're focused on. Mm. It kind of, I was reading something that said you divulge some of the experiences that have shaped your life, but also influenced your writing. Tell us about that.
Well, they were not, so the book starts with me kind of trying to work out about a way of being alive again. So I had this, I think one of the things that's sort of suicidal thinking, suicidal ideation is what they call it. But what I, it was like a desire for absence, a desire not to be myself and not to be in my body. And in one aspect of this book is a real archaeology of my own experiences of sexual violence, of rape, of all those things. Just trigger warning for people who are listening, give yourself a little hug. To experience, to understand what it feels like to be treated as an object, to be treated by another human being as somebody who doesn't matter, which I think, or somebody who could just be treated like rubbish, used like a thing. And women feel so much shame for that. And I thought, it's not my shame. I did not do this to myself. Somebody else did a bad thing to me, as many of your listeners will relate to, I'm sure. Mm. So in some ways, it was an archaeology of that shame and of that understanding. And you talked about being open, being vulnerable. Sometimes the only way to tell the truth and to give other people courage is to say, this stuff happened to me and I'm okay. Mm. I would rather it didn't happen. It's made me into a different person. But you can get through it, and you get through it by not holding up the illusion of patriarchy, if I can call it, by pretending it's okay. You know, I did give account of one experience of being sexually assaulted by a headmaster when I was 12, who I loved and adored. And he introduced me into so much of the thinking. But that experience, fragmentary and momentary as it was, has affected my whole life. Mm-hmm. It's affected my sense of myself. So I thought, just say it, put it out there. The shame is his, not mine.
Mm. And someone reading that, you know, there's this quote by Baldwin where he says, you know, you think you're alone in a particular experience or you're alone in the world, and then you read.
Absolutely.
And then you suddenly, it's interesting. And then you suddenly find out that actually this thing that I'm experiencing that is so isolating, mm-hmm. is not just me or about me.
Absolutely not. And that there's a kind of, not a solidarity of the wounded. I wouldn't call it that. I thought of Baldwin a lot when I was writing, and Audre Lorde, who said famously, your silence will not protect you. Mm. And it's a solidarity of the truthful, if you know what I mean, where you push back the sort of traumas that have happened to you to the people who've perpetrated them. But what I did find, what that enabled me to do, was retrieve a great deal of the joy and pleasure in my life, because, you know, all we have is the body, and the body experiences everything, the pleasure and the pain, the love and the hurt. So kind of through writing the book, as I've, you know, for example, that brilliant Baldwin quote that you use, you find a way to be friends with yourself, and you find how to be friends with other people, and to say, it's fine. This is how we go on. This is how our lives are.
Yeah. And so the title of the book is Love and Fury. And so I imagine, as you've just described, so some of it is about the things that have invoked your fury, like, you know, the violence, the loss. And then what are some of the things then that have been the things that have been about love that have given that you love?
I've loved so many. I mean, my children. I have three children. So I talk about them and the way they've sort of transformed me, the kind of intensity of feeling. My sister features. I lost my sister very suddenly. We were like so close and then meshed halfway through the writing of the book. So I had to stop and wait a whole year and a half before I could even go back to the manuscript. And it was when I went back to it, she was just everywhere, like one sister is, you know, she was just there borrowing my clothes and helping me with my kids. And so that feeling of her was very strongly in the book. Men that I've loved, men that I should have done. I just think it's a problem that they're still around in the world. So the sort of love, I think for me, I've been involved in all sorts of politics, but and writing, and the driving force of that is a force of love for the world and for people, and saying, I want to record what it is to be alive in this fleeting way.
Mm.
The fury is this outrage, you know, growing up when there was, you know, still under apartheid, and then, you know, the sort of immense cruelty, the sort of totalitarian nature of a patriarchal society. We all feel it, like looking behind your back before you go out, afraid in your home, afraid out of your home. That makes me furious. It's not right. You know, it's just not right. And I still have that simple childish feeling that if things are not right, you must tell the tale. And that for me, the telling of the tale is always the writing. Even though you get in trouble for telling tales, I just thought someone's got to say it. Someone has to find the words to say it. And that's what I tried to do in this book. And it does feel different to my fiction. The fiction, you kind of know where it's going to land. You're much more protected, as you said at the beginning. With nonfiction, with a memoir, I had no idea. It does make one feel very open or exposed, but also open-hearted. And I think that's the essence of love, perhaps, is if you have an open heart, you can love people. If you can't tell the truth, your heart closes up. That's what happened to me. That's why I had a breakdown. My heart closed up and kind of froze. So I had to break completely apart, rewrite it all, and come alive again somehow.
Mm. It being a memoir, because often we're told the difference between a memoir and an autobiography. A memoir is, I guess, a snapshot of some part of someone's life, whereas an autobiography will give you, you know, I guess, their full life. Is that the case here, where we have a snapshot of some of the, you know, the crucial moments of your life, versus it being the full account of your life?
Holy moly, if you wanted the full account, Arthur, it would be a different platform, I think. It's kind of, I thought about that a lot. I mean, I think a memoir is often sort of triggered by one particular experience. I think it's a kind of hybrid of the two. What I've explored, I've done a sort of archaeology of memory, of feeling. So, for example, I've done it, like looked back to understand shame and how that works. So there is the time scale starts sort of 2018 when I was living in London then till kind of, well, I got married again a year and a half ago. So it wonderfully ends with a wedding, like a good Jane Austen novel. But it goes down into the younger self that I was, and then of course into childhood and family histories. Because in many ways, I'm sure many of your readers are familiar with the book, The Body Keeps the Score, and various ideas of how memory and trauma live on in the body. That is what I'm interested in. So it's kind of in linear time, but also in this non-linear time, which is trying to find a way to evoke for the reader what it feels like to be alive, that strange mixture. And one of the things I realized, I'm sure everyone else knew this, but I'm a bit slower than most, is that memory happens in the present. Even if you're remembering something wonderful or awful from very long time ago, your brain is not, mind is not a kind of police report. So a memory is a mixture of what's happening now and what happened long ago, and kind of things that are similar in between. So some of it is trying to understand literally how the psyche works. My problem from having written so many thrillers and novels is that I'm used to writing, I don't know, maybe it's just the pulse of me, with this kind of pace and electricity. And I kept on thinking, no, that is not how it feels to be alive. It's much more, it's much slower and more meandering. So I've got how it is to be alive with the pace of a thriller. And I'm sorry, I was the best I could do.
Sure. It sounds fascinating. And Margie, I must thank you so much for joining us this morning and making time for us.
Oh, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That is internationally acclaimed writer Margie Orford speaking to us about her new memoir, a book called Love and Fury.